Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Climate change, peak oil, and the economic crisis have sparked a global sustainability movement called the Transition Town Movement. In 2005, permaculture educator Rob Hopkins came up with this concept of a transition network where people come together to create societies that do not rely on fossil fuels. In 2006, Totnes, England became the first official transition town. And since then, the movement has spread to 1,105 towns in 43 countries. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about transition towns and local activism. How viable is this movement, and how does it differ from other forms of activism? Floyd Earl Smith is a writer and activist based in Oakland. He got involved in transition towns in Brixton. It's a city within London, in 2008. He's since been involved in transition consulting and transition initiatives around the Bay Area, and he also works with 350.org in the Bay Area. And Floyd joins me here in studio. Hi, Floyd. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Maggie Fleming, co-director of Transition US. It's a nonprofit that provides support and training for transition initiatives across the US. They're working in close partnership with the Transition Network, a UK-based organization that supports international movements. And Maggie joins us from Sebastopol. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
So, Floyd, since you were involved in 2008 in Brixton in the UK, what is a transition town?
Well, I can talk about that through how I found out about transition towns and how they helped save me. And so I had what's called a peak oil moment. And a peak oil moment is when you find out just how difficult things are and how much trouble we're in economically and in terms of resources. I walked into a convention of green businesses and nonprofits and saw a table for transition towns. At that table, I was able to see
people who looked happy, cheerful, and engaged, and yet they knew everything I did about how serious climate change was and other problems. So transition towns are local initiatives that try to get people to do things locally, and the key term there is relocalization, bringing everything into your neighborhood or town kind of ambit. If you're in a city, it's the immediate area around you. And the idea is to get your food, your clothes, your entertainment, your fun, more and more from people who are close to you and people who you know personally. And this is a great thing to do just for the heck of it. And also, with the impact of rising oil prices and greater economic strains, it makes you and your community more resilient.
So talk about some of the concrete changes you saw in Brixton. Again, it's a city within London.
Yes. So Brixton introduced the Brixton Pound, which is a local currency, and a very early successful example of local currencies, too. Local merchants took the Brixton Pound, and the city of Brixton actually took on the job of paying some of their bills in Brixton Pounds as well. Since then, we've had similar initiatives in different places in the world, local currencies, and many of them are associated with transition towns like Bay Bucks here in the Bay Area.
And Maggie, you're co-director of Transition US. How would you describe this transition town movement?
Well, I would echo what Floyd's saying around the kind of positive energy. And so what it really is, the way I see it, is transition is that bridge between what people can do on the individual level and then kind of the larger scale government activity and international activity. And it's connecting with your neighbors, with people in your community, and taking direct action. And I can give a few more examples from the national level. We just had a wonderful tour with the founder of Transition Network, came over and got to visit several different transition communities across the country. And it's what's really unique about transition is that it looks different in every community. So it's the community recognizing where the need is in their community for resilience. And so some of the things that we got to see and hear about included these large-scale food cleaning projects in Florida where they just gave away over 100,000 pounds of food to a food bank in their community. The group in Marbleton, New York, hosts a free health clinic once a month for their community. There's lots of groups doing innovative work around the economy, like Floyd mentioned. Also some great connections to education and starting to work more with youth and different faith groups. Transition Los Angeles has some great partnerships with local churches using creating edible gardens in the churchyard. So there's just countless examples of great, amazing local action that's taking practical, optimistic steps to change the world.
And so I'm assuming that people who are involved in the transition movement are working with activists that are involved in other movements, right? That would, it seems like that would only make sense.
Absolutely. And Floyd could talk more about his work with 350.org, and I'm sure Catherine can talk about the local examples, but there's lots of wonderful partnerships at the national level. We're working closely with numerous organizations, including 350 and Post Carbon Institute, and the local level. That's really what transition is doing, is saying, well, what are groups already doing here, and how can we connect the different activities, and where is the additional work to be done? So there's lots of great synergy with other groups doing resilience work, doing economy work, doing food work, all of these different issues.
And Catherine, you started Transition Albany in 2009, and you wanted to tell us what works and what doesn't work. So why don't we start off first by talking about what doesn't work? What have you learned over the years?
So I came back from a transition training full of excitement that my life finally had a way to go. And I had known for a long time that there was a big problem, and I really felt powerless to do anything about it. So I came back with these big ideas to my community and started to share materials with people that I knew and people who knew people I knew. And we got a small group together who were very excited about the idea of initiating a transition movement in Albany, which is a small town of about 17,000 people. And I think one of the mistakes we made was thinking too big too fast and not looking at what was already there and partnering with it, with what who was there. You know, we came in with this so-called new idea when already there were groups that were working in the right direction. And if I had to start all over again, I think I would do it differently than how I did it. The other thing that happened was I was very much pushing it. I felt like I have that kind of personality, which I lead things. And it's really a good idea to get everybody moving together rather than having one person kind of leading the charge, I would say. That said, we did the mayor. I spoke to the mayor, who was very open to what I was telling her, and she invited me to come and speak to the city staff. And as a result, the city staff, some of them really ran with the ideas and started all kinds, and they may have already been thinking about it, I'm not sure. But anyway, they started a lot of great things, like a crop swap, which was where people would bring their excess garden produce and exchange it with each other. And that was later taken on by Transition Berkeley, who developed it into an even larger sharing initiative that goes on there weekly during the summer and monthly during the winter. First Saturdays at Ohlone, Greenway, and Sacramento.
And let me ask you, Catherine, when you brought this back to Albany, how did you talk about it with the community? I mean, what really got people excited about getting involved in something like this?
We had materials that came back from the training that I took, and I shared those, really. What was exciting, I think, was that there was something that we could do locally that could make a difference, because, you know, we were aware of the dangers of the way society was going. We could see we had our own fears about what was happening, and here was something we could do locally. We could take action locally. We could encourage people to grow their own food. We could grow our own food in our own gardens. We could show people how to grow food, for instance. This is one way to bring back food production into our own local community. The sharing and gift community is something that has been exciting for us. And at the moment, we have somebody who's... And what I've discovered is that as we've understood the... As we've sort of grasped the range of possibilities. People show up, individuals pop up out of apparently nowhere who are saying, I'm interested in taking this forward, or I'm interested in taking that forward. And so we have somebody recently who showed up who's really interested in creating a local economy. And I'm excited by that. I think when you hold a vision for something, and when a group of people is holding a vision for something and carries on taking a step day after day, even if it seems impossible, things show up, people show up. It's quite magical.
Floyd, can you talk a little bit about that? What has your experience been like when it comes to actually getting people involved in these issues and keeping them excited? Because the things we're dealing with right now are pretty intense. I mean, you're dealing with, I mean, the three things that the Transition Town movement is focused on is climate change, peak oil, and the economic crisis.
Yes, all heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And whenever one of us goes into despair about any part of this, we call it a peak oil moment. It's like going into a little bit of shock, you know, and realizing that everything you see around you is on pretty uncertain foundations.
Yeah.
And things can change in a hurry. We're seeing that just as a local example at the moment, while things are still pretty good, as big money moves into San Francisco, we're seeing a lot of people affected by rising prices.
And it's interesting because we were talking about this before the show. I find that a lot of people don't really know what's going on in their own backyard because there's so much focus on national issues. But now that so many people are being forced out of San Francisco, the rents are just off the charts. A lot of people are now focusing on what's happening in this town.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I've gotten to be an activist on both sides of the bay just in the last few years, and it's been a wonderful experience. I find in San Francisco, we tend to have a lot of very sharp, very highly skilled activists who don't have a lot of time because they're working constantly to pay the bills. Across the bay in Oakland and Berkeley to a somewhat lesser extent, we've got people who often have great skills but also have more time and can be a little more focused on work like transition towns.
And so talk about just how you get people involved in this. And can you give us some stories about success stories?
Certainly. One of my favorite success stories is we had a meeting in San Francisco, and we showed a movie about the impact of the financial crisis. And some of the people who were there were children, and their parents had brought about a dozen kids. And I actually got to speak introducing the movie. And I was so moved to be speaking to these kids, I suddenly understood what school teachers find so exciting about their work. And the parents were thrilled. We were able to let the kids participate quite a bit, and their questions and comments were really sharp and very insightful. And, you know, if there was an emperor without any clothes, they would tell you that that's what was happening. Another thing I want to mention, too, is that Transition Town's idea tends to catch on with people who are more liberal and environmental when it comes to planning and setting things up. But we often find that when we run activities, we get a wide range of people. Hmm. If we do a crop swap, we get everyone in town. So oftentimes it's better if we don't lead with our understanding of the big picture, but more what we're trying to do.
Interesting. And I bet if you talked about economic issues and the influence of money in politics, you'd probably get a wide range of people also.
Up to a point, but everyone factionalizes as soon as you mention politics. But when you talk about teaching kids how to grow food, then everyone rolls up their sleeves and helps.
That is Floyd Earl Smith. He's a writer and activist in Oakland. He got involved in Transition Towns in Brixton, a city within London, in 2008. He's since been involved in transition consulting around the Bay Area. He also works with 350.org in the Bay Area. Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009, a city of 17,000 people. And Maggie Fleming is co-director of Transition US, a nonprofit that provides support and training for transition towns across the United States. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the concept behind transition towns? Basically, it's a lot of people coming together to create societies that do not rely on fossil fuels and a way to live and deal with issues like climate change, peak oil, and the economic crisis. And the idea really is to focus on local activism. So when you're talking about local activism, what is most effective? And I know so many of you have been involved locally. What really works? What doesn't? What lessons have you learned? And if you have any questions about these transition towns, We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Maggie, how many transition towns are there across the U.S.?
There are 144 official transition groups in 36 states, and there's many more, so hundreds more that are in the forming stage. So what happens, groups start to come together, and then as they get more established, then at some point they'll apply to become official and get listed on our map and get more support in recruiting and outreach. So it's a fairly large number and growing, definitely, and with the national tour that I mentioned, it's definitely we're getting a lot more people interested and starting to take action. And it's what's beautiful is transition can exist on so many different levels. So a lot of groups that may not be part of that official 144 groups are doing transition in their own way. And so there's lots of connecting with those groups. And for example, in last month, there was the Northern California Convergence, which was a coming together of transition groups from around the region as well as permaculture groups from around the region. And some amazing local groups, Urban Tilth was out here, Movement Generation, just numerous groups that are doing this resilience building work. And whether or not they're official transition groups, there's lots of ways of partnering and connecting and really deepening this work.
And is there anything visible about this? If I went to Transition Sebastopol, could I see anything that was directly connected to this movement?
Sure. So a lot of the towns, you could come and you could see maybe some landscaping, some permaculture work in the community. In Sebastopol, if you were here a couple months ago, the local group did a community fair that was featuring electric cars. And so people came and brought out all these examples of electric cars that people could buy. And it really looks different everywhere. I'm trying to think, like Catherine mentioned, you could stop by the crop swap. Berkeley just had a movie night with filmmakers talking about the movie Within Reach. So there's lots of kind of subtle things you might see. What it tends to look like initially is lots of more popping up of food gardens, and so people creating more of their food. And then what you're probably not seeing is that building of relationships. So that's kind of harder to see, but it's an amazing thing that's really happening as a direct result of people coming together. So people starting to, you know, there's lots of interesting things around time banks and just informal sharing economy. So people might be taking care of each other's dogs or setting up tool libraries with their neighbors and sharing tools or, you know, basic kind of vacuum cleaners. And so there's lots of interesting, you might have to kind of poke around a little bit to see what's happening, but there's a tremendous amount happening on the ground.
I can add that in Richmond or Bernal Heights here in San Francisco, you can go to the local library and they have seed libraries. And you can actually check out seeds, go grow plants, take seeds out of those plants, and then return them to the library for the next season.
And Catherine, what about Albany?
Well, we have, in partnership with the city, we have been working a piece of land in Memorial Park, a highly visible area within Albany, and turning it into a demonstration permaculture garden or food forest, with the idea to, and it takes time to establish a food forest, so there are young trees there now. The idea of a food forest is that it's a garden that kind of takes care of itself, where you don't have to give a lot of inputs. Eventually, at the moment, we're doing quite a lot of inputting. But it's an example of how to grow a lot of food without a whole lot of energy and effort and a lot of inputs. We're doing that. We also have a monthly potluck, which draws in people from various kinds of communities roundabout, as well as the local transition people. Our latest effort has been to convene a conversation. You've probably heard of the issue around the people who've been camping on Albany Bulb. The city has decided to evict them, and there's really nowhere for them to go. So we've convened a conversation with all the community organizations in Albany on how to help provide extremely affordable housing within Albany, because we have the same problem as they do in San Francisco, that people are forced to leave. Teachers who teach in Albany schools cannot afford to live here. People who have lived here for a long time, their children can't afford to live here. So it's an issue that the city hasn't really addressed. And so the community groups are going to be providing ideas and support and education to the community on how we can reshape Albany's idea of itself so that it can include people from across the spectrum to live here, because that's what makes a rich community.
I wasn't familiar with Albany Bulb, but according to the Berkeley Daily Planet, Albany has no homeless shelters and apparently little or no affordable housing, and only one of the 60 or so campers has been housed so far. So you are actually doing outreach to different members of the community, because Rob Hopkins, who started or came up with the concept of transition towns, said in an interview that the key challenge is, you know, how do we do this in a way that takes it out of being perceived as alternative culture, that it resonates across the spectrum of people of all kinds of different interests, not just people who garden, because obviously you want to reach more people. So how is that being dealt with, Catherine, and how have people living in this homeless camp responded to the transition town movement?
Well, we haven't talked to many of them. There are a couple of spokespeople who have been, basically at the moment, their first priority is finding somewhere to live where they feel safe, or finding somewhere to sleep where they feel safe. So I don't think they're particularly thinking about transition town or not transition town. They're thinking about survival right now. And we want to support them. It's not like we have a label that says transition town on everything we do. We're people first. And that's one of the things I think that's true, which is that the movement, the transition movement, is arising everywhere, whether you call it transition or not. As Maggie said, you know, the whole aim, the idea of growing our own stuff, of becoming more self-supporting as communities, it's arising all over the world, and certainly all over this country, not always with the transition name. So your question was about...
Well, no, I was just wondering if there was a connection made between the people you work with and this homeless encampment. And Floyd, you wanted to jump in there?
Oh, just to make an example of how activism takes many forms. As a member of the transition movement, I went to the Forward on Climate rally in February of this year and got involved with 350 Bay Area. Just this last week, the Air District for the entire Bay Area region passed a resolution calling for 80% reductions in greenhouse gases by 2050. And I got to speak as that process went along, and on their anti-Keystone XL resolution as well, as both a member of Transition Towns and as someone involved in 350 Bay Area. So this can go to a regional extent, and we're finding in 350 and at rallies that a lot of the transition people are there being active at that more public-facing level as well.
Right. I was actually going to ask you how this is influencing city politics.
Well, that's a great example. And the idea of relocalization is really popular once it catches on a bit with local elected officials, because it takes the focus off following national politics, horse races, who's up, who's down, and more toward making practical changes in people's lives. And Supervisor John Avalos, for instance, here in San Francisco, has been a real friend to a number of activist movements, including transition.
On today's Your Call, we're talking about the Transition Town Movement. It's spread to 1,105 towns in 43 countries. The movement is to build community resilience in the face of big issues like peak oil, climate change, and the economic crisis. And so we're talking today about the power of local activism. If you're involved locally, we'd love to hear from you. What really works? What doesn't work? How do you deal with sort of mainstream politics and getting involved with that, and then working on these issues outside of politics? What do you think is most effective when it comes to dealing with these major issues? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Is always better when more people get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking about how communities around the globe are responding to fracking. Last month, activists from over 20 countries took to the streets to speak out against fracking. So where is it growing the fastest? Who's pushing against it? And what can we learn from these grassroots movements? And then on Thursday, we'll be talking to members of Greenpeace about how their rainbow warrior ships are changing the game when it comes to civil disobedience on the high seas. The rainbow warrior ship recently landed in San Francisco, and they're giving free tours on the weekend. You can find more information at greenpeace.org. Today, we are talking about effective local activism, specifically this growing movement called the Transition Town Movement. It's been formed to deal with a number of issues like climate change, economic instability, the erosion of community, declining biodiversity, resource wars. And so we're talking about how groups at the local level are taking on these issues. What is most effective? What doesn't work? If you're involved in a local group, we'd love to hear from you. What has changed over the years as we're dealing with massive issues like growing inequality and budget cuts and so many things, it's hard to keep up. But what are your thoughts on the power of acting locally when it comes to these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. The other question is, how do you stay engaged? Because I know a lot of people are tired. I mean, really, we've been doing shows about this for so many years, but how do you stay engaged and excited about getting involved at the local level? Today, we're joined by Floyd Earl Smith, writer and activist in Oakland. He got involved in Transition Towns in Brixton, a city within London, in 2008. Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009. And Maggie Fleming is co-director of Transition US. And let's hear from William in Palo Alto. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm with Transition Palo Alto and Transition Silicon Valley, and just calling in to talk to y'all and, share a little bit about what we're doing as well.
Okay, so what are you doing?
We have a number of groups. We've started up Transition Palo Alto and Transition Silicon Valley about 4 years ago, and we've been doing a great deal of awareness raising and outreach and community building. We really, really resonate with things that Maggie and Floyd and Catherine have been saying about the community building and just the connections between people.
Can you give us some examples of what you've been seeing?
Do you mean in the connections between people?
Yes.
A number of things like the book groups and transition cafes and movie nights have become staple parts of people's weeks or people's months. And I don't know if we started out with that intention. I think there was the initial idea of doing awareness raising and getting the feedback from people that the actual getting out and having conversations in person with folks instead of over the phone or over email, or instant messaging, which has become really, really popular these days. And I think at the heart of most of the things that we do is the community building.
So you're in Silicon Valley, dealing with some of the same issues that we're dealing with in San Francisco. As your housing prices are off the charts, your homeless population has increased. How do you decide where to put your focus? Because that's what a lot of people struggle with.
We are in a similar way to how we keep our energy up, helping people find areas that they're passionate about. I've found over the years of doing the activism that I do that if I'm doing something that I'm lukewarm on or really don't care about at all, my energy level just plummets, and it's very hard to stay engaged. And also very hard to stay engaged if I don't care deeply about the people who I'm working with, if it's not exciting to come into work. And so a lot of for instance, in a book group where we would talk about the Transition Companion and read it through with each other, a lot of times people get really fired up about the subject matter, and they want to, you know, they want to form a group around it and start recruiting people into it. And a lot of that ability to recruit people is creating a positive atmosphere within the group.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, William. That's William.
You're very welcome.
Working on Transition Town, the movement in the South Bay. You know, I want to ask you all kind of a big question, because it's when you think about what we're dealing with right now, I mean, we've got major issues. There was a great story on NPR this morning about a town in, I have to look this up because I want to get it right, but in Nebraska, I believe it was. And the reporter went to her hometown and found that things are so bad in this town. There are no jobs, no good paying jobs. There's a heroin overdose once a week in a town of 14,000 people. And one man said he takes care of his family and makes them safe by keeping about 30 guns in the house. And he's taking his daughters to gun practice. So, I mean, we've got like major issues happening right now with economic instability, climate change. Look at what's happening in the Philippines right now. There's just so much. How do you deal with these massive issues at the local level, Floyd? What do you think is most effective? And how do you keep people engaged in these issues?
I think that what William mentioned was the value of having live conversations with real people. We try to use, in transition, we try to use online networks and social media as supporting elements for getting together in person. But if you have your main focus of personal connection online or electronically, it's kind of empty calories, you know? You don't have the same meaning and resonance to it. So this just being local, just focusing on things locally, by itself makes a big difference. It can matter a little less what you do, although growing food is always a good go-to strategy for any transition initiative. But it matters a little bit less what you do than, as William also mentioned, who you do it with, and that you enjoy it and develop real deep personal connections. Catherine hosted a lot of that just through meetings at her house in Transition Albany.
We actually started a resilience circle, which is an idea that came from another group on the East Coast, but it entailed a 7-week curriculum of learning about all these kinds of issues. And then it evolved into a support group, which is still very, very sweet. And most of the people who were in that resilience circle, many of the people who are in that circle, are now the people that are active and working on these issues in Albany. And I have to say that we also have a book group, and it's those face-to-face friendships that are driving Albany's transition movement at the moment, I think.
And I just wanted to mention, I found that piece on NPR. I highly recommend listening to this piece. It's called Reinventing the Dwindling Middle Class May Take a Revolution. This is an NPR headline. And Kelly McEvers went back to her hometown, Lincoln, Illinois, and just found a decrepit town with no jobs and a lot of people really suffering. And the takeaway is that this is happening across the country and really deserves a lot more attention.
Meg, you have a national view. Does Transition have a lot of initiatives in economically struggling areas?
Yes, and this is actually one of the areas I see as great potential for the transition movement here in the U.S. You know, definitely the groundwork, and the organization's only been here in the U.S. since 2008, and so I think a lot of the initial work is doing what Catherine was just mentioning around creating the relationships, really building the capacity and the initial community organizing. And what we're seeing now is as these groups mature, there's more and more opportunity for engaging in some of these issues around the economy. And the Transition Network in the UK has been really leading the way, developing materials and models for helping create local livelihoods and doing economic blueprints. And so that's one of the things that the Transition US is looking at right now. We're actually raising funds to be able to adapt some of those materials and then roll them out in pilot cities here in the US where there's particularly a need for that. And it's really, you know, I think that that's exactly where the need is. If people have more jobs and the money staying in the community, it's really building the resiliency at a kind of a deeper level and have kind of more long-term impact opportunity.
Are you seeing any of these movements in more conservative parts of the country, Maggie?
I would say that the early adopters had, you know, as you'd expect, a lot of them are in the kind of more liberal communities, but there are definitely down in California. I know Laguna Beach has had some interesting connections with people across the spectrum. In Texas, you wouldn't think it, but one of our strongest initiatives is in Houston, and a lot of the people used to work for the oil industry and for Shell, for example. And so there are groups, especially as the movement continues to grow, we are seeing more and more of these groups in different communities. And as Floyd mentioned, part of the appeal of the transition movement is that it does aim to be inclusive and really working on these issues that cross different political perspectives.
And Maggie, how would you address that question? I mean, how do you deal with these massive issues at the local level? And what do you think is the benefit of doing this locally, this kind of work locally?
I think that, continuing to support the groups in maintaining the work and avoiding burnout is key. So that's a huge piece that we're looking at, is how to help sustain the groups. And some of that is through training. Some of that is through funding. It's amazing, all the amazing volunteer work that's happened with these groups. But so there's a lot more that these groups need to continue the activities. And I think, we just, like I said, seeing what's happening at the local level, and then as you start to scale up and see and really, there's groups, we do the annual transition challenge where we encourage groups, have in the past during the month of May, to take on one or more actions. And so a lot of the transition initiative groups will organize a whole slew of actions, so 500 or more actions. And this last year we had 6,000 actions. So once you start to add up the impact of all of these different groups, you can really see the scale and how it has an opportunity to scale up.
That is Maggie Fleming. She's co-director of Transition US, a nonprofit that provides support and training for transition initiatives across the country. Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009, and Floyd Earl Smith is an activist in Oakland. He got involved in transition towns in Brixton, a city within London. And today we're talking about this growing movement. The transition town movement has been formed to deal with big issues like economic instability, overpopulation, climate change, declining biodiversity, resource wars. We can go on and on, can't we, Floyd?
Oh yeah.
And we'd love to hear from you. What is the power of really dealing with these issues at the local level, and what is the best way to go about it? If you're involved in a local organization, what works, what doesn't work? If you have success stories you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. And then also, I think it's important to talk about how you stay engaged and you stay balanced, because it can be kind of overwhelming. So if you want to talk about that, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I know transition focuses on local government, and I wanted to point out something that many people don't understand about land use and environmental authority and law, and that's that county and city zoning code are actually very powerful. They're often more effective, at least within the boundaries of a jurisdiction, than the state of California, in this case, whatever it be. And for instance, Santa Cruz County has just essentially banned all oil drilling within the boundaries of Santa Cruz County. This is in response to the new pressure to use hydraulic fracturing. It was rather easy for Santa Cruz County because they have no oil development now. But in any case, there is no preemption issue. In other words, the state of California has not written any law that makes it superior to a county. So any county in California has the authority to ban oil drilling within its jurisdiction. This makes counties very important because the state is, through the passage of a recent law, SB4, has essentially declared that it's going to, without so many words, it's going to lay down for the oil industry. So it's going to be up to the counties to handle this issue for the people of the state of California. So counties have this authority. They can simply say no oil drilling within the boundaries of our jurisdiction under their zoning code. And this applies to many other industries as well. People need to understand that local government is often often retains a lot of power, which it may not use, but that power exists, and local government is more responsive to citizens than is any other level of government.
Well, thank you. It's a really good point, Kevin. Thanks for calling. And Maggie, since you work with various movements across the country, how connected are they with local politics, or are they trying to work outside of the system?
It's definitely both. A lot of it's outside the system, but we are seeing a lot of groups that are working on local ordinances and initiatives. I know in Fairfax, California, the Transition Group helped pass a town initiative to have zero waste by 2020. A lot of the groups have been helping pass ordinances around having chickens in urban areas and the like. So we're seeing more and more of that, and I think as the groups continue to strengthen, there'll be more opportunities. And there's definitely we've heard some of our the transition individuals been running for office and being elected. So there's definitely, you know, I really agree with what Kevin shared around opportunities in local engagement and local government.
And Catherine, what would you like to add about these movements being involved in the political system, or at least connected to politicians so they have a voice at that level?
It's a very interesting area, because I have run into trouble myself personally here in Albany, which is has an interesting political color. And when we talk about taking political action or becoming activist in different areas, if you're related or seen to be part of a transition movement, you can also find that that becomes a polarizing.
Are Hello? You still there? Yes, go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, I am. Yeah, it can be polarizing within the community.
Sorry about that. We're having a phone problem. But you're still there, Catherine. Go ahead. Catherine, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still there.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. It is important. I'm not sure quite how to deal with this, because I think that activism is becoming increasingly important. I don't think we can really believe that just by growing our own cucumbers we're going to change the world. I mean, we have to take some really drastic action as communities. And I think we might... I don't know whether it's possible to do that without alienating some people who would really like to grow their own cucumbers.
Well, okay, so
maybe that's the extent of what they see as necessary.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up, because I have to say a lot of people roll their eyes when, I mean, community gardens are great, right? But when you talk about that over and over and over again, a lot of people say, okay, but what about people on food stamps? Or what about people who cannot get in-home supportive services, people with disabilities? Mm-hmm. I mean, they can't go out and spend a lot of time growing food. Mm-hmm. So how do you do both?
Well, we actually...
And reach out to those communities. Sorry, Floyd, go ahead.
Oh, no worries. We actually segment what we ask of different people. So some people are better at sitting in meetings and talking, which is a skill I've developed over the years. Some people are better at and more able to roll up their sleeves and put plants in or take weeds out. And other people are really good at educating. Some people will do a lot of reading and share what they learned with the rest of us in a shorter form for those of us who don't have time. So we actually have a number of people who are retired and people with different abilities and educational backgrounds involved in transition, and people find a lot of ways to contribute. It's really lovely. When you tell people that your only choice for working locally is the people who live near you, then you really see people differently. You see them for their full range of skills.
There is also, we have someone here, bless her heart, who is willing to go and sit in council meetings and commission meetings and keep abreast of what's going on in the city. And it was through her doing that we were given this really, you know, reasonable piece of land in Memorial Park to do our edible landscape project. And we are now working closely with the Planning and Zoning Commission on this whole idea of affordable housing. So you asked about being involved with local government. And talking about local government, I would just like to give a shout out to Richmond, whose mayor, Gail McLaughlin, is doing transition throughout the whole town without using that word.
Oh, really?
I would say she is. Hmm. She is very interested in making the town more resilient, resisting Chevron, encouraging cooperative businesses. She even traveled to
Ecuador.
Ecuador, that was another thing, yes. But she traveled to Brittany to check out the Mondragon cooperative system, and she brought it back to Richmond. So, good for her.
Yes, I had the great privilege of being arrested in Richmond. We had a big activity against climate change and against Chevron on August 3rd. Bill McKibben came out and spoke in San Francisco the night before and in Richmond on the day of the protest, and he was among the first to get arrested. So more than 200 people were arrested, but I don't claim a lot of credit for being one of them because under Gail McLaughlin's leadership, the police department in Richmond was actually very supportive. They made things very easy and very positive so that we could make that statement and get a lot of headlines and a lot of media and local attention without a lot of trauma or difficulty for the people involved, like Bill McKibben or myself.
And that is... Are we okay here? That is Floyd Earl Smith. He is an activist with the Transition Towns. He's based in Oakland. Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009. And Maggie, are you still with us?
I'm here. Okay. Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay, good.
Quite engaged.
Great. Maggie Fleming is co-director of Transition US. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from longtime activist Evie in Berkeley. Hi, Evie.
Hi. I just had my 84th birthday, and I've lived in Berkeley for 52 years, and I was a Berkeley teacher for 35 years,
wow,
and very much in the community. And I just want to say that I am thrilled to death to hear everybody you're talking to today talking about what they're doing, because it makes me feel like the alternative to what is public policy has not died, and that it's just taking another breath and looking out to a different horizon. And the things that these people are doing have certainly, they've been done before, but the question is, you need to stay with it and keep doing it and organize. Organize, I think, is the magic word. You know, we organized for 7 years and marched against the Vietnam War, and people organize gardens. They're all over Berkeley now. We do have a lot of results from the work we did, but we need a whole fresh population. Like, I think what I heard people who were active in politics during the Occupy movement is that it kind of died for lack of direction or whatever. I don't know. I didn't take part of it. But this is really good. I mean, it sounds repetitive, you know, grow a garden or this or that. But it isn't. It's a fresh breath and moving in new and better directions.
And Evie, well, and also the state cracked down really hard on the Occupy movements. But since you are 84 and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Just give us some insight into your experience. What do you think works? And when you talk to the younger generation, what do you tell them?
Well, you can't. Well, I do talk to the younger generation because I tutor my grandchildren and I go into their schools. And I'm still a teacher forever, the rest of my life, whether I'm teaching or not. You have to have a lot of staying power, and you have to have people who stay directed in the cause. So we had our overall organizing thing was the teachers union in Berkeley. And so we used the teachers union to go out from. But that was our central location. We were all earning livings. We all had places to live. So we didn't have to agonize over those things. People do have to agonize over those things now, obviously, because they've had such poor government policies for support network. But you really almost have to be middle class in order to devote your attention to something beyond your own needs.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's... You know, that's a very biased view, but most of the people who did the organizing were, you know, coming from comfortable homes, from jobs they had, and food on the table.
Right.
And if you don't have that, you can't pay attention to anybody but yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you're eating processed food and you're not healthy, which is another major problem in this country.
Yes, the health issue is a much bigger issue now than it seemed at that time.
Right. Well, Evie, I thank you so much for calling. Happy birthday. And would you stay on the line? We'd love to get your phone number.
Yes, and I've talked to you before about teaching stuff. I call in every about once a month.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We'd love to get your number. We have just a couple minutes left. Floyd, final thoughts. We got a few emails from listeners who said, we need this to be tangible. We're facing major crises right now.
Yes, we are. And we're kind of spread among our local, regional, state, national, and world attention levels. And we find that if you put your attention on all of those levels at once, you can be ineffective across a really wide range of activities. And so we think that the local focus is really promising. And it can seem hard, you know, we're so aware of a famine here and a typhoon there, yet working to reduce our emissions here in the Bay Area or getting people out of their houses and off the television and off the internet for a while to grow food. Voltaire said in his novel Candide, cultivate your own garden, and that's a good starting point.
And Maggie, final thoughts, about 30 seconds?
Just an appreciation of Evie's taking another breath and recognizing that, yes, this work has been going on and there is a need to continue and just continue to work together and take those local actions.
And Catherine, final thoughts?
I think that we need a new story. The old story hasn't been working for quite a long time. And when we concentrate on the new story, even if we don't know how it's going to work out, we do get that resurgence of hope in our hearts. And I would like to recommend the book, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, by Charles Eisenstein.
Catherine Sutton started Transition Albany in 2009. Maggie Fleming is co-director of Transition US. And Floyd Earl Smith has been involved in Transition Consulting. He also works with 350.org in the Bay Area. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are communities responding to fracking around the globe? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the expansion of hydraulic fracturing. Last month, activists from over 20 countries took to the streets to speak out against it. So where is it growing the fastest? Who's pushing against it? And what can we learn from these grassroots movements? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.